arms. Give it your all.
We'll drink the wine till the cup is dry, and kiss the girls till they'll not cry, and toss the dice until we fly, and dance with Jack of the Shadows.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Tales of Red Arm. I'm your host, Justin, and we're jumping into Chapter 37, Fires in Kyrian. It's a bit of a point of view shift. Ironically, we are still on a ship, or just not on the same ship. and we're jumping to Egwene's perspective. And this is Egwene, Nynaeve, and Elaine heading south towards Tyr. So, on the ship, Egwene, you know, is giving a respectful bow to the ship's crewmen, and they're on a ship called the Blue Crane. And she's keeping an eye on the forested Kyrian shore. That's about 20 spans of water away. But she's noticing these villages, or what were villages at one time. And most of the houses, at least half of the houses, are just smoldering piles of rubble, with just the chimney just sticking out of the ruins, and different houses, you know, furniture's laying out in the yard, doors and windows are broken. Nothing lived or moved in the village except, you know, a half-starved dog that just kind of looks around for food or something. But Egwene feels a little bit of a queasiness. She's trying to be the dispassionate, full of serenity, Aes Sedai, you know, that she thinks she should be, or that she will be at some point. So she's trying to emulate that. But this isn't the first village or plume of smoke that she had seen on the Arranon, since they'd gotten to the border of Kyrian. And Kyrian is in a kind of a civil war going on for whoever's going to take over the throne of Kyrian, but also because of said craziness going on inside of Kyrian's borders, it's also brought rise to a lot of banditry. Now, Captain Elisor sometimes had to get close to Kyrian because of mudflats, and a mudflat is kind of like a almost like a sandbar, but it's like a buildup. And they shift in this area of the river. And as this says, mudflats, they shifted in this part of the river. Pretty obvious in that regard. But every time they got really close to the Kyrian inside, they never saw anything. Well, I should say, no, saw any living thing, person or otherwise. But they zip past this village and she's treated very respectfully by the sailors and their kin, captain and crew. And she's wearing her great serpent ring on her right hand, and it's a lot of bowing. Now, novices have, I think, a version of the great serpent ring. I have to recall it, but the accepted have essentially the same ring as the Aes Sedai, but they're supposed to wear it on a different finger or hand or whatever. Like, you have to wear it in a very specific location, but when you're Aes Sedai, you can move it to wherever you want. And so, because all three of them are accepted, anybody not from the White Tower is going to just assume they're naturally an Aes Sedai for whatever reason, because it's safer for them to do so. But the captain and majority of the crew were born mostly in Tarvalon. And she had an argument with Nynaeve and had won the argument, even though Nynaeve had been sure that herself was the only one of the three old enough for people to believe she's Aes Sedai. And Nynaeve had been wrong, because her and Elaine received a couple startled looks when they first got there. But they could have been just newly raised Aes Sedai, or youngly raised Aes Sedai. Albeit, not having warders should have put somebody up on their toes and be like, wait a minute. Young Aes Sedai without a warder? What are they, Reds? Which they could have been, but I feel like newly raised Aes Sedai would have worn the colors of their Aja so much. But maybe the common folk don't know this. But you think people who are raised in Tar Valon would know this. Oh well. I guess the tower doesn't put out too much in terms of information on how to spot a sister or not. Everyone just assumes they're a sister as long as they're accepted or higher. I mean, granted, accepted typically wear accepted dresses. And they don't leave the tower. So this is kind of an anomaly. But Captain Elisar's eyebrows had climbed almost to where his hair would have been if he had any. So he bald as an egg. But he had smiled and bowed, and he's like, an honor, Aes Sedai. Three of them to travel on my vessel. Honor indeed. I'll give you a quick journey as far as you wish, and no trouble with Kyrenian and brigands. I no longer put in on that side of the river. Unless you want it to, of course. Andoran soldiers do hold a few towns on the Kyrenian side. It's an honor, Aes Sedai. But he was even more surprised that they wanted only one cabin among them, and even Nynaeve didn't want to spend a night alone amongst all three of them. None of them wanted to spend a night alone if they didn't have to be. So they could each have a cabin to themselves and no extra charge. They had no other passengers. The cargo was on board. And if they had any urgent business, you would not wait in even an hour for anyone else who might want passage. But they said one cabin would be fine. So he didn't understand, but Chin Elisor, born and bred in Tar Valon, was not one to question Aes Sedai once they make their intentions clear. If two seemed very young, well, some Aes Sedai were young. Which is true. Not very many, but it is known to happen at some point. And for his point of view, is he going to tell them you're too young to be Aes Sedai? What do you... That's a way to end your life early. So they go by, and the forest is turning a little bit low, more into grassy hills with thickets and stuff. But Egwene kind of wishes that she could had an Aes Sedai to question right there, like one she could actually trust. And she could feel the twisted stone ring in her pouch. And she tries it every night, except for two of them since leaving Tar Valon. And it had not worked the same way twice. Once he gets into Tel Arunriad, the only thing she sees has been the Heart of the Stone again, but no Sylvie to tell her things, and there's definitely nothing about the Black Aja. This next part I'm going to read. Her own dreams, without the Tirangreal, had been filled with images that seemed almost like glimpses of the unseen world. Rand holding a sword that blazed like the sun till she could hardly see that it was a sword. She could hardly make out that it was him at all. Rand threatened in a dozen ways, none of them the least bit real. In one dream, he had been on a huge stones board, the black and white stones as big as boulders, and him dodging the monstrous hands that moved them and seemed to try to crush him under them. It could have meant something. It very probably did. But beyond the fact that Rand was in danger from someone, or two someones, she thought that much was clear. Beyond that, she simply did not know. I cannot help him now. I have my own duty. I don't even know where he is, except that it is probably 500 leagues from here. She had dreamed of Perrin with a wolf, and with a falcon, and a hawk. And the falcon and the hawk fighting. Of Perrin running from someone deadly, and Perrin stepping willingly over the edge of a towering cliff while saying, "It must be done. I must learn to fly before I reach the bottom." There had been one dream of an Aiel, and she thought that had to do with Perrin too, but she was not sure. And a dream of Min, springing a steel trap, but somehow walking through it without so much as seeing it. There had been dreams of Matt, too. Of Matt with dice spinning around him. She felt she knew that one, where that one came from, of Matt being followed by a man who was not there. She still did not understand that. There was a man following, or maybe more than one, but in some way, there was no one there. Of Matt riding desperately towards something unseen in the distance that he had to reach. And Matt with a woman who seemed to be tossing fireworks about. An illuminator, she assumed. But that made no more sense than anything else. She had had so many dreams that she was beginning to doubt them all. Maybe it had to do with using the Tyr Angreal so often. Or maybe with just carrying it. Maybe she was finally learning what a dreamer did. Frantic dreams, hectic dreams. Men and women breaking out of a cage, then putting on crowns. A woman playing with puppets. And another dream where the strings on puppets led to the hands of larger puppets. And their strings led to still greater puppets. On and on until the last strings vanished into unimaginable heights. Kings dying, queens weeping, battles raging. White cloaks ravaging the two rivers. She had even dreamed of the Shanshan again. More than once. Those she shut away in a dark corner, she would not let herself think of them. Her mother and father, every night. She was certain what that meant, at least, or thought she was. It means I'm off hunting the Black Aja, and I do not know where my dreams mean, or how to make the fool Tyr Angreal do what it should. And I'm frightened, and homesick. For an instant, she thought how good it would be to have her mother send her up to bed, knowing everything would be better in the morning. Only mother can't solve my problems for me anymore. And father can't promise to chase away monsters and make me believe it. I have to do it myself now. Now, I would like to point out, other than the fact that my dog is barking and brewing because reasons, that all these dreams seem to play a role in the entirety of the series. Or do they? Because dreams in Tel'ar Unriah don't always play the same way. It could be a sign, a foretelling. It could be what has happened or what is happening right this instant. It's not clear necessarily. Now, that's for the user of Tel'ar Unriah. Sorry about the dog. The clarity of each of these dreams is different dependent upon what the reader sees. Like Robert Jordan tells us, the reader, like, you know what's happening. Or do you? Like, some of these things, like, if they don't seem familiar. Like, we see certain ones, like Perrin with a wolf, a falcon, and a hawk. Well, we've seen Perrin with a wolf. We have seen this familiarity with a falcon-like character. But we haven't seen a hawk. We haven't seen a falcon and a hawk fighting. Perrin running from something deadly shouldn't really surprise anyone. Because, I mean, there's bad people chasing people. Perrin stepping willingly over the edge of a towering cliff saying, it has to be done. I have to learn to fly to reach before I reach the bottom. We haven't seen that necessarily. Or have we? So there's certain, like, instances of things that we are not particularly sure whether or not it's a thing that we see. Like, is it something that is happening right this instant? Is it something that already happened but Egwene doesn't know about it, so she's kind of getting filled in the details? Or is it something that's going to happen in the future? Or is it something that's a potential happening in the future? There's a lot of little cool things about that. Now, Matt being, you know, followed by a man who's not there, we kind of understand what that means based off of most of the story as it is so far. But there are some things that we don't know. And that will probably get filled in later on if it's something that's not just a mere coincidence or something. But be as it may, it's a really cool way for the viewer to understand more than the characters. And since we can't tell the characters what's happening, we have to just be pulled along for the ride to see what will happen. Now, that being said, she doesn't know how far in the past it all was, and she didn't want to look back. It had been a warm time, referring to her, like, her home with her mother and her father and everything. She just wants to see them because she's feeling homesick and to hear their voices. And she's like, well, when I wear this ring on the finger I choose by right, I'll go visit. So in other words, when she becomes an actual Aes Sedai, a legitimate Aes Sedai, not a pretend one, she'll go visit them. And she had finally let Nynaeve and Elaine each try sleeping one night with the stone ring. And she's, like, very reluctant, but she's kind of surprised by it. Not quite like Lord of the Rings, like, my precious, or anything. But they had awakened to speak of what was definitely Teler Unriad, but they hadn't seen more than a glimpse of the Heart of Stone, and that was about that, and none of it was really any use. So, a thick column of smoke was now abreast of the Blue Crane, and about 5 or 6 miles from the river. And it would almost have been a cloud, but she's definitely sure it's not. And she can't really see a whole lot there, but she still knows that something's going on. Probably a recent raid from brigands. But Elaine shows up, coming on deck and joining her at the rail. And they're all wearing sturdy wool. That was one that Nynaeve had won. Their clothes, you know. Egwene maintained that Aes Sedai always wore the best, even when they traveled. And she had been thinking of the silk that she had worn until her Unriad. But Nynaeve pointed out that even with as much gold as the armor that had left him back in the wardrobe, and it was a fat purse, they didn't have any idea how much things would cost downriver. And the servants said that Matt had been right about the Civil War in Kyrian and what it had done to prices. But Elaine, to Egwene's surprise, had pointed out that the Brown Sisters wore wool more often than silk. And Elaine had been eager to be away from the kitchen, so Egwene probably thought she'd wear rags to get away from the kitchen. But she's thinking, I wonder what Matt slept to. Probably trying to dice with the captain for whatever ship he's traveling on. Because she obviously doesn't know that he has got really good luck and is, like, multiple gold purses. He probably could have gotten them several gold purses if they wanted to. But Elaine's like, oh, it's all so terrible. And Egwene's like, what? And Elaine's like, that, pointing at the distant smoke. He's like, how can you ignore it? He's like, well, I ignore it because I do not want to think about what people are going through because I can't do anything about it and because we have to go to Tyr and what we're hunting is in Tyr. And she was a little bit more vehement than she intended and was surprised by it. And she's like, I can't do anything about it and the Black Aja is in Tyr. But the more she thinks about it, the more she become certain that they would have to find a way to the Heart of the Stone. Maybe the No one but the High Lords of Tyr were allowed into it, but she was becoming convinced that the key that's bringing the whole trap was getting into the Heart of the Stone. And obviously, Tyr is not exactly friendly to Aes Sedai, so there's that whole entire shenanigans they're going to have to deal with. And Elaine's like, I know that, Egwene, but I can't help but feel for the Kyrianan. And she's like, oh, well, I have heard lectures of the wars Andor fought with Kyrian. B'nai Aes Sedai says you and Kyrian have fought more than any two nations except Tyr and Ilion. But Elaine gives her a sidelong look, and Elaine had never gotten used to Egwene's refusal to admit she was Andorran herself. At least lines on the map said the Two Rivers was a part of Andor, and Elaine believed the maps. Of course she would, because it means it's her territory someday. Like, why would she not? And it'd be weird for her to see somebody who's allegedly one of her subjects that doesn't acknowledge her like royalty or her, well, she acknowledges her royalty, just not over her. So it's kind of an interesting scenario for Elaine. But Elaine's like, well, we have fought wars against them, but since the damage they suffered in the Aiel War, Andor sold them nearly as much grain as Tyr has. And the trade has stopped now, with every Kyrianan house fighting every other for the Sun Throne. Which is a little history background that we kind of need to know, because everyone's fighting for the Sun Throne. Who would buy the grain or see it distributed to the people? If the fighting is as bad as what we see on the banks, well, you can't feed a people for 20 years and feel like nothing for them when they must be starving. And Egwene's like, a gray man! And then all of a sudden Elaine jumps and looks every direction in the glow of Sidar around her. And she's like, where? And she's like, looking around the decks, and he's like, making sure the captain's not nearby. Captain Elisar stood on the stern, and the shirtless man holding the long tiller, and different sailors up in the bow and scanned the waters and all that stuff. And she's like, "Fool, me, Elaine, not you, so don't glower at me like that. A gray man is after Matt, Elaine. Must be what the dream meant, but I never saw it. I am a fool." I'm like, "Well, yes, because everyone saw that except for you. And you've seen more gray man than Matt has, so how does he say that?" But the glow around Elaine vanishes. He's like, "Well, don't be so hard about that. You know, can't be hard on yourself that much. Maybe it doesn't mean that I do not see it, and neither did Elaine." But she pauses, and her red-gold curls swung as she shook her head. It's like, "But it doesn't make sense either. Why would a gray man be after Matt?" Because, you know, she doesn't know that he's Taviren, apparently. "There's nothing in the letter that my mother could harm us in the slightest." And it's like, that's because you're assuming it's about the letter you have, not about anything else. Now, hypothetically, it could be something where the letter could be getting hunted down by the Black Aja or one of the Forsaken or somebody to swap out with another letter and have a different person sent and basically be like, "Oh, mother, come attack the nasty Aes Sedai. They're keeping me captive. I only barely managed to get this letter out to you by certain means. Please come destroy them and save me," or something like that. Some nonsense. And in the current fever pitch that Morghais has about the White Tower, she might actually come do it. You never know. There is a hypothetical there, but it's not a very realistic one. But with Matt, Perrin, and Rand being Taviren, I don't remember, but I thought Egwene knew about this. I don't remember if they're aware of the Taviren among them from their village, but they might. But Egwene's like, "I don't know, but there has to be a reason. That's got to be what the dream means." I'm like, "Well, there's nothing, if that's what you dreamed and it is correct, then there's nothing you can do about it." And Egwene's like, "Well, I know." And she doesn't even know if Matt's already left and is ahead of them, or, you know, behind them. And he's like, "Well, Matt would probably have left without any delay." He's like, "It doesn't do any good. I finally know what one of my dreams means, and it doesn't help a hemstitch worth." And I was like, "Well, if you know one, maybe now you'll know others. Just sit down and talk them over, maybe." But the Blue Crane gives a shuddering lurch that throws Elaine to the deck and Egwene on top of her. And Egwene struggles to her feet, and the shorelines no longer slid by. The Blue Crane had halted, and the bow raised, and the decks canted to one side, and the sails flapped noisily in the wind. The captain, Chin Elisor, pushed himself to his feet and ran for the bow, leaving the tillerman to rise on his own. "You blind worm of a farmer!" Which I love that. He roars at the man in the bow, who's clinging to the rail to keep falling the rest of the way over. "You dirt-grubbing get-of-a-goat!" I love these things. "Haven't you been on the river long enough to recognize the water ruffles around a mud flat?" He seized the man on the rail by the shoulders and pulled him back over the deck, but only to shove him out of the way so he could peer down over the bow himself. "If you put a hole in my hole, I'll use your guts for caulking." I gotta say, sailors, man, they got some creative use. The other crewmen are getting up to their feet and scrambling. And then Nynaeve appears to the head of the ladder, heads down to the passenger cabin, straightening her skirts. She gives a sharp tug at a braid, classic, and she frowns at the knot of men at the bow, but then strides over to Egwene and Nynaeve. He's like, "He ran us into something, didn't he? After all his talk of knowing the river as well as he knows his wife, the woman probably never received as much as a smile from him." Now, what we know from previous adventures is that Nynaeve doesn't like ships. She really doesn't like ships. And she gets motion sickness rather easily. And that's one of the reasons she's not up top, because seeing everything go flying by would probably make her hurl constantly, and that doesn't fit a Aes Sedai. So obviously she's really peeved. There's no reason to attack a man and his wife. But she didn't want to go, you know. I guess I should say Egwene and Elaine didn't really see a reason following her as she pulls, I guess, men away so she can get closer to the captain and see what's going on. Now, I do find this funny where, you know, they could use weaves to free themselves, like the ship, just be like shifted over the way or something, or maybe push the ship back, you know, magic, do something. But clearly I said I would never do that. I'm like, what, use the one power? I mean, you could. Does it necessarily befit an Aes Sedai? Maybe not really, but you're kind of in a hurry. You're trying to get somewhere. And if you're stopped, what do? Find another way or just freaking just weave a power thingy and move them? And you'll get extra respect. More than necessary, because you already have more than necessary, but more than necessary from the captain and his crew. If you free the ship, man, he'd probably give you free rides. Well, I mean, he probably practically gives him free rides as it is, but he'd probably give you free rides for life and a life of luxury on a ship because you kept him from danger or something. He might even try to monetize you. But. And they're like, well, he'll have us faster off if he's left to it, being Egwene's thought process. And Nynaeve was probably telling him how to do the work, because that's Nynaeve. Now, Nynaeve hasn't really become everyone's favorite, at reader's perspective, quite yet. We'll get there, but sometimes she is annoying. But there's a bit of agitation. And then the captain's hands can be seen, waving in protest, and Nynaeve is striding away from them, and Elisor is hurrying behind her, mopping his round face with a large red handkerchief. And his voice is very anxious and became audible as they drove. And he's like, it's a good 15 miles to the next village on the Andor side, Aes Sedai, and at least 5 or 6 miles downriver on the Kyrian side. Andoran soldiers hold it, it's true, but they do not hold for the miles from here to there. And he wipes his face like it's dripping with sweat. And Nynaeve's like, it's a sunken ship. That's what we hit. The work of river brigands, the captain thinks. Which you'd think would be even easier to get rid of. It's not a mudflat. It's quite literally just a ship. Just break it with the power. Oh, we're going through. Like, it'd be easy. But they don't think about this for reasons unknown. And he's like, well, he's trying to back off with the sweeps, but he does not think that'll work. And Elosaur's like, well, we were running fast when we hit it because I wanted to make good speed for you. And he's rubbing even harder at his face. And he was afraid of the Aes Sedai would blame him. And so Egwene realizing this, he's like, we are stuck hard, but I don't think we are taking water. And there's no need to worry, Aes Sedai. You know, another ship will be along. Two sets of sweeps will surely get us free. And there's no need for you to put ashore. I do swear it by the light. This is when you should be listening to, you know, the captain, but clearly Nynaeve, the much more experienced sailor, knows better. But at the same time, Egwene and Elaine should know of Elaine's affinity for the land over ship and water, and should know that there's a motivation to this. But then Egwene's like, wait, you're thinking of leaving the ship? Do you think that's wise? And Nynaeve's like, of course, but then frowns at her. And Egwene returned with a frown with a level stare. And Nynaeve kind of goes in a calmer tone, if still slightly tight one. It's like, well, the captain says it might be an hour before another ship comes by. One with enough sweeps to make a difference. Or a day, or two, maybe. But I don't think we could afford to waste a day or two waiting. We could be in this village. What did you call it, Captain Jiren? We can be in Jiren in 2 hours or less. If Captain Elisar frees his vessel quickly, as he hopes, we can reboard then. He says he will stop to see if we are there. If he does not get free, though, we could take the ship from Jiren, and we might even find a vessel waiting. Captain says traitors do stop there because of the Andoran soldiers. And she takes a deep breath, but her voice gets a little bit tighter. He's like, have I explained my reasoning fully enough, or do you need more? Elaine's like, oh, it's clear to me. It sounds a good idea. You think it's a good idea, don't you, Egwene? I'm like, Nynaeve and Egwene butting heads right now is killing every ounce of reasoning among the three of them. Granted, I don't think they had too much to begin with, but it's killing every ounce of that. And like I was mentioning earlier, they could have just broken the ship underneath them. Because if river brigands sink a ship, usually that's to trap other ships. And if you trap other ships, that means there's brigands lying in wait. At least that's what a normal person would think. But obviously, the like super experienced water craftsmen that Elaine, Egwene, and Nynaeve are, all three of them probably not use a boat very often, if at all, all of a sudden know that that would never happen or never be the case. So clearly, just knocking the ship away or breaking the ship, crunching it into the ground, whatever, would make it easier for everybody on the ship or on the river. But instead of doing that, we're like, eh, you guys can fend for yourself. Everybody else who comes here, eh, they can fend for themselves, whatever. But Egwene's like, ah, I suppose. She grudgingly nods. And Alistair's, but I said, aye, at least go to the Andor Bank. The war, the brigands, and every sort of ruffian and soldier's not much better. The very wreck under our bow shows that sort of what sort of men they are. He's making a lot of valid points. Like, let's be honest, he's making a lot. And then he was like, well, we haven't seen a living soul on the Kyrian side. Because that clearly means that all the bushes, the brush, the trees, the grass, the hills. That means that there's nobody there. Out of sight, out of mind. That's Nynaeve's motto. In any case, we are far from defenseless. And I will not walk 15 miles when I can walk 6. I'm like, can you walk 15 safely or 6 in danger? I mean, which one do you want to do? But Elisor is really sweating now. He's like, of course, I didn't mean to upset Aes Sedai. Of course, you're not defenseless. I did not mean to suggest it. And he keeps wiping his face furiously, but it still glistens. And Nynaeve opens her mouth, glanced at Egwene, and seemed to change what she had meant to say. And he's like, I'm going below for my things. She kind of tells the air. She goes halfway between Egwene and Elaine, and then turns to Elisor. He's like, Captain, make your rowboat ready. And he bows and scurries away before she even turned to the hatch, shouting for men to put the boat over the side before she was even below. And Elaine's like, if one of you says up, the other one says down. If you don't stop it, we might not reach Tyr. And Egwene's like, we will reach Tyr sooner once Nynaeve realizes she's not the wisdom any longer. We are all, and she didn't say accepted, there are too many men around, but she's like, on the same level now. And Elaine sighs. Now, this is a good point. They are on the same level. Granted that out of the three of them, Nynaeve has the actual most leadership experience. While Elaine has royal blood and has more experience learning of, like, running a country, Nynaeve's actually been doing essentially that for the village alongside, you know, the women's circle and the the village council and all that stuff. Like, she has actual skill in kind of like organizing people to do things. Doesn't mean she has skill in everything she does, like making good decisions when it comes to boats and brigands and walking, but you never know. But the story needs this to kind of move this way, so we're kind of running with the story. But eventually the rowboat is out and ferries them ashore, and they're standing on the bank with walking staffs, and, you know, their belongings and bundles on their back. That totally fits Aes Sedai. Hanging about them in pouches and scrips with rolling grasslands and scattered copses around them. We got some hills, forests, all this type of stuff. But the sweeps on the Blue Crane were cutting up froth, but not able to budge the vessel. But Egwene turns and starts south without another glance, and she did it before Nynaeve could take the lead. The others caught up to her, and Elaine gave her kind of a reproving look. Nynaeve walked staring straight ahead. Elaine told Nynaeve what Egwene had said about Matt and the Greyman, but the old woman listened in silence and just said, well, he's going to have to look after himself, without pausing in her stride. But eventually, Elaine gave up trying to make the other two talk, and they all just walked in silence. But nearby, there were clumps of trees along the riverbank. Eventually, hid the blue crane. Thick growths of water oak and willow, and they didn't go through the copses, small as they were, but for anything that might be hiding in the shadows under their branches. But a few low bushes grew scattered around, and but they were too sparse to hold anything but a child, maybe, much less a brigand, and they were widely spaced. Nagwain's like, well, if we do see brigands, I'm going to defend myself. There's no Ammerlin looking over our shoulders here. And Nynaeve's mouth, thinned, as you'd expect. He's like, well, if need be, she told the air in front of her, we can frighten any brigands the way we did those white cloaks, if we can find no other way. And Elaine's like, I wish you'd not talk of brigands. I would like to reach this village without. And all of a sudden, a figure in brown and gray springs up from behind a bush, standing by itself pretty much right in front of them. And that's the end of the chapter, because cliffhangers! gotta love cliffhangers. But yeah, what'd you guys think? That was chapter 37. And we learned a little bit about the situation with the captain. We learned a little bit about the dreams. We learned a little bit about this, that, and the other. A lot of cool little details that kind of build a little bit of world building, especially about how people in Tar Valon treat Aes Sedai when they're born there and bred there. I made some points about how they could have used the one power to get out of the situation. I'm curious if anybody has any thoughts on that, any theories or anything like that. If anybody does, I'd love to hear them. You can reach out on either Facebook, Twitter, or email. Facebook is just Tales of Red Arm. Twitter is at Tales of Red Arm. And you can directly reach out to me at talesofredarm@gmail.com. Love to hear it and see if anybody's got some reasons as to why. I mean, the easiest answer is the plot demands it. Granted, it could have been achieved potentially in some other ways. But, yeah. Yeah, there's bound to be some other hypotheses that just make sense. But I'm interested to know what you guys think. What do you guys think about Egwene and Nynaeve's rivalry at the moment for who gets to be in charge? Because, you know, it shouldn't be royalty. But, yeah. So, we'll go ahead and call that good. Chapter 38 is the next chapter, and it's an interesting chapter due to the fact of the content. And those of you who have already read it, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't read it, you're about to find out. Veterans, don't spoil it for the newbies. But yeah, thanks everybody for hanging out. We'll look forward to the next one, and I look forward to you guys joining me for the next one, chapter 38, and we'll see you guys then. Until then.
We drink all night and dance all day, and on the girls we'll spend our pay, and when we're done then we'll away to dance with Jack of the Shadows. We'll toss the dice however they fall, and some of the girls be they short or tall, and follow young Matt wherever he goes, to dance with Jack of the Shadows. We'll toss the dice however they fall, and some of the girls be they short or tall, and follow Lord Matt wherever he goes, to dance with Jack of the Shadows. We'll give a yell with a bloody curse, and hog the maids, it could be worse, as we ride away with the dark ones first, to dance with Jack of the Shadows. Yeah!